Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Welcome to See Dreams, the podcast exploring Southeast Asia and why it's the region to watch for the next decade. I'm Kenneth Nguyen, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts Phil Van and An Vo. And today we're going to get into this discussion about digital nomadic trends that became hugely popular during the COVID pandemic. By some reports, there's an estimate by the year 2035 of a billion digital nomads roaming the earth. And today we're going to find out who they are, explore what they do and why they do what they do, and their impact on the local communities, especially in Southeast Asia, in which, we hear and we see YouTube videos all the time about how they affect the local region, the local economy. And so stay tuned, and we're going to jump right into this phenomenon right here on Southeast Asian Dreams.
Digital nomads take remote working to another level. Unlike traditional remote workers who often stay put in a home office, which we all know well, thanks to COVID, nomads are constantly on the go using technology to work from just about any location. This isn't just a shift in where they work, but a complete transformation in their approach to work itself and how they see their professional lives. The whole digital nomad thing started in the 1980s with companies like IBM, who were already tinkering with the idea of remote work. They realized their hardware could free up their workers from needing to be chained to their desks all day. And most digital nomads are, surprise, American. 47% of digital nomads fall into the 30 to 39 age range, while 14% are in their 20s and the rest are over 40.
Yeah, let's get into this whole idea of, is it hegemonic sort of like structural ways that countries, first world countries, go into third world countries and set up shop as digital nomads, right? Like countries who are, you know, the dollar's higher, the pounds are higher, you know, in Canada, Australia, these things allow people from the first world countries. Is that even a politically correct thing to say, first world countries anymore? But developed countries to come into places like Vietnam, Bali, and all these places to really just, is it decimate their communities?
And so I think before we go there, we need to define some of the factors that were, you know, led to the ability to have digital nomads.
Yeah, but I bring that up because that's sort of, I think, the tease that this is why we're talking about digital nomads, because that's sort of, for me, why we're going to get into all that. And we're going to get to the facts of it.
At some point, there'll be reverse colonialism. But I think you're quite right. I think when we think digital nomads living in the US, Australia, and Western Europe, essentially, we come from a very privileged place, and that privilege is born of things like earning higher incomes in higher value currencies like the pound sterling, Deutsche Mark, Swiss franc, US dollar, Australian dollar, things like that. And what you do see is that the overwhelming majority of digital nomads do come from these Western kind of countries. Let me have a look here. So like Phil was saying, 47% fall into the 30 to 39 age group. 24% of American digital nomads travel with their family, which is quite startling to me. I thought it would be more of a, you know, single person type of endeavor. Most digital nomads are male. 76% of digital nomads are Caucasian, which is, well, not surprising for me, kind of expected. What is surprising is 18% of digital nomads are African American. That's pretty interesting.
That's a high number.
Yeah.
Yeah. African American.
Yeah. Half of digital nomads are millennials, and 54% of digital nomads are married or live with a partner. And as an aside, more than half of digital nomads are non-religious, which kind of
makes sense. Yeah.
It makes sense. And so, like you said, Ken, you know, in 2021, 2023, currently there are estimated to be around about 35 million nomads worldwide globally. But, you know, some studies have shown that that number will increase dramatically into possibly 1 billion in 2035.
Which, can we just stop everything right here and say, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I know that's like very binary, but like, I think it's kind of a good thing that you have all these people who get to just go all over the world and kind of like repopulate ideas and be part of like this bigger fabric of international society.
Well, if you think about it, the Industrial Revolution moved people from farms into the cities, right? And made them sedentary in terms of living in cities, urban centers, and suburban centers, right? In the first world anyway, the economy is moving away from manufacturing and the like, manufacturing commercial, into more of a thought economy. The ability to untether yourself from a certain location.
Yeah.
Would mean that the post-industrial revolution would be more of a digital revolution, and digital nomads is a byproduct of that digital revolution, right? Being able to untether yourself from a particular place,
yeah,
and be able to do what you want to do,
yeah. But it's not anywhere. But it's not just a physical place; it's a physical place, and you're not like tied to time. You can do this stuff whenever you want, right? As long as you're doing your own internal deadlines and milestones. You could really just create your own patterns of living.
But
right?
one of the problems of that too is that you also, by untethering yourself from a particular location for a long time, do you also pose problems with identity, right? If you're American, maybe you've lived in America for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're a digital nomad, what's your concept of identity and how does it develop?
That's blooming. That's evolution.
Is that a global citizen kind of mentality?
That is a global evolution of mankind. It is something that we are becoming. We're removing nationalism. I mean,
but you're arguing though that many or most global digital nomads take that on consciously, right? Insofar as I purposely choose to go to country X, country Y, country Z, and I will partake of the cultural experience that each of those countries have.
I mean, I think they're forced to do it.
I don't think that's the case at all.
This is the debate.
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. Like in listening to Digital Nomads talk at length about this, because there are a ton of podcasts. If any of our listeners are interested, you could just Google Digital Nomad and it seems like they all have podcasts. They definitely have priorities. As they move about, their priorities seem fairly consistent and also fairly narrow, but maybe that's reductive. But one of the priorities is working hours versus hangout hours and time zones, right? Like working in certain areas of the world is more advantageous based on where their sort of central hub is. They do have to report for office hours. But sometimes it involves reporting in the middle of the night based on where they are. Like if they're in Thailand working in America, so it could be really hard because it's a daily nightly schedule.
Yeah.
Versus somewhere in like Eastern Europe where it's a little less.
So for the benefit of the audience, I think there's something that's left unsaid here. Several things. One is, who do these digital nomads work for? And why is it that time zone difference is key to all of this?
Well, not for everybody though.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I think it's typically a slew of tech startups, right? Or big tech companies.
Located in which countries?
Different countries, but a lot of them are American based. Yeah. Because a lot of the digital nomads come from the States. Sometimes they'll be working for a European-based company, which shifts the time zone they have to report.
So mainly the employers are mainly employers or firms that contract these digital nomads are either based in the US or North America and Western Europe, right?
I think so, yeah, typically. Yeah.
So 17 million, apparently, digital nomads are US citizens or based in the US or work for US companies. And overall, another 18 or so are from outside of the US, i.e. mostly Western Europe.
Mm.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. But I mean, other priorities, this comes up a lot. Wi-Fi access, just the infrastructure of the country they're living in. this may be, again, reductive and very partial, but just in listening to them talk, a lot of them seem very concerned with how good or bad the Wi-Fi is, because that connects them to their job.
Right.
It's their tether. And I would say they prioritize that over like a lot of other aspects of maybe the country.
Yeah.
The customs they're involved in.
That's like your lifeline.
Yeah. Exchange rates, also really important. Exchange arbitrage has come up a few times. Just the ability to sort of benefit from an advantageous exchange rate and live relatively cheaply.
So they're basically earning in US dollars and spending in Mexican pesos or
Vietnam dong.
And, you know, just as an example, Eastern Europe is much more advantageous than Western Europe for obvious reasons, but Eastern Europe's now sort of the exchange rate's, I guess, decreasing, which is displacing some digital nomads if they can be displaced. I don't know if that's possible. Also, tourists versus off seasons in areas seems to really affect them. They tend to ride out a shoulder season, which is between a peak period and an off season. Or to prefer to live in certain areas during their off season.
Yeah.
Because ironically, digital nomads don't really like a lot of tourists in the areas that they're crashing. I mean, that's living in.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think, certain descriptions were that they were quote unquote shoulder to shoulder with tourists, and they seem to want to live more as locals or in what they refer to as digital nomad communities. A lot of communities exist in Southeast Asia, Thailand and Bali specifically. Weather is also a huge consideration. I think more than in other maybe subcultures, I hear weather talked about very frequently.
Yeah.
The quality of like sunsets in Africa came up multiple times in listening to.
So they want to avoid the typhoon season or the rainy season, or
yes.
Maybe it was a little bit too cold, they'll move to a different work location.
Yeah, they it reminded me a bit of Endless Summer, and in more ways than one. That's a surfing documentary about surfers that would sort of chase waves and also like good weather.
Yeah,
to just continue to surf year round. That's sort of
very similar,
very very similar. Even the way that they kind of refer to local culture is there's a, despite being in tech jobs, often high powered tech jobs, there's a sort of easy breeziness to the way they talk about things. And, you know, they talk about beach access and you know, warm climates or tropical climates versus like freezing cold conditions in places like Canada, which they prefer not to go to. And you don't see a big footprint of digital nomads in. There's also a bunch of other considerations. I mean, there's a digital nomad visa that you can apply for and get. And
For some countries.
And it varies. The qualifications vary by country. But like for Costa Rica, Malta, Thailand, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Georgia, Indonesia, those are all places you can access with this visa, which allows you for longer stays, with the understanding that you're there to work remotely for a long period of time.
And why do these countries have special digital nomad visas? I assume they're fairly new kind of visa class.
I think it spurs the economies.
Yeah.
You know, in Greece, they were dying a few years ago. You know, their economy was in the toilet.
Yeah.
And, you know, to drum up marketing, you know, to get everybody here, let's come and spend money, spend US dollars here. Let's come and spend the pound here, work here.
It feels easy to maybe from a bit of a privileged Western point of view to criticize the average digital nomad. That's my impulse is to want to critique.
Yeah.
What ultimately is a bit of a fancy form of gentrification.
Yeah.
Right. But there are also huge upsides to the digital nomad culture, kind of feeding into the tourism kind of industry in a lot of places. And as we know, like places like Vietnam, which I think it's trickier to be a digital nomad in because of the government, but digital nomads still exist in, are fed by tourism, right? That's a huge industry in a lot of Southeast Asian countries. And if this trend toward digital nomadicism helps the economy in a big way, then maybe that is a legitimate upside.
Can I ask a question then? So some countries have moved, recognizing that digital nomadism is a thing, right? And so they've purposely set aside or developed or created a new visa class, the digital nomad visa class. And not all countries have it, and not all countries who are visited by digital nomads have it as yet. For example, Vietnam doesn't have one at the moment, but Vietnam is one of the big digital nomad kind of destinations in Southeast Asia. Bali, Indonesia has it. Malaysia had it beginning of October 2022. Thailand has it, a specific visa class for digital nomads. This must mean that these governments recognize that there is a distinct difference between normal tourists and digital nomads. So that would imply also that there are different advantages and disadvantages of being a tourist versus advantages and disadvantages of, like, to the local economy of digital nomadism. Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. I'm going to get into it right now. I thought about what you're just saying. I'm like crunching numbers. If you think about tourism, it's only when you think about like Vietnam and people passing through as a tourist, you get pockets of time as a tourist. You have 2 weeks, 3 weeks, right? But when you're going through Southeast Asia or Vietnam, you're only doing 2 days, 3 days in each of these major cities like Hanoi, Saigon, or Da Nang, right? But if you're a digital nomad and you're welcoming people into your, you know, to Bali, into Greece, into these places, you're really doing the people there at the government, on the government level. I think the idea is you're infusing Western money into these places, and it's a really good thing. I'm listening to both of you talk right now, and I'm like, I'm playing the other side. I'm thinking, if I was the local people and not an armchair anthropologist looking out in 100 years going, this is basically colonialism, you know, from a 30,000 feet. It's good for the local economy, no matter how you look at it right now. And I'm pretty sure that the locals would be like, we want the government to do more of this.
Yeah.
When you say, is that for tourists or the digital nomads? Well, both.
Obviously they love tourists to come through, but digital nomads, I think, are more welcomed as the years go on.
Well, I think a good question to ask is it a form of colonialism if these people don't stay? If the entire notion of being a digital nomad sort of predicated on staying for a while and then leaving, then in fact they're not really colonizing an area for very long or at all. It's just long form tourism. For example, the digital nomad visa is good for up to a year. In comparison, a visa in the Schengen region of the EU is good for 90 days, 180 days, but you have to leave and come back. So it's like two 90-day stints. And that would cover areas like Austria, Belgium, Croatia, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, France, all the sort of EU countries, 29 countries in all. So the ability to be a digital nomad in the Schengen area is greatly lessened. But a year-long tourist in Thailand, I imagine, would be welcomed because that's a year of Western
money
expenditure.
Infusion.
It's coming from a much bigger income, right?
I don't think anybody on the ground, whether they're the locals or the government, is going to say, we don't want those people here. I think for the most part.
I take issue with that.
No, I say for the most part. For the most part. It's how could you fight it when they're bringing in so much money for the local economies?
Okay. What does that mean? Break it down.
Money. Just money.
Okay. And if they spend money, if they make money, I don't know.
Your life gets better in the short term because now you are like, if you're mom and pop's restaurant, a service, anything in those, you know, Weaving area, you know, of tourists. There's these places that benefit greatly from digital nomads.
So I'll do a counter to that. So I understand that if you own a restaurant in Bali, you own a restaurant in Saigon, Hanoi, that caters to digital nomads, right? Let's say that's one or two people, right? You'll benefit. What about the hundreds or thousands of local customers who visit that restaurant as well?
They don't go to the same restaurants. That's my guess. They just don't.
Cafes, restaurants?
They don't really go to. Locals go to other places. They go to their restaurants. Digital nomads go to where they go to, for the most part.
Right. And where do these digital nomads live?
I think in areas that are highly concentrated with digital nomads or
but these places that where they choose to set up shop and live used to have locals in them, right? And then you're saying that the digital nomads come in, they're earning US dollars, euros, and they're willing to pay a lot more than what locals are willing.
I mean, this is gentrification.
When you say that everyone's going to welcome digital nomads with open arms in the local economy, I don't think that's the case at all.
I never said everyone. I didn't say everyone. I said most people.
But I guess I would, and I really appreciate the argument.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely the first thought that crossed my mind, and we should get into it deeper. But I also would question, is it gentrification if they're not staying permanently? Or if, let's say, there's a kind of a community of digital nomads, maybe on the outskirts of one of these towns, right? But it's not displacing like a dramatic number of local residents. It's just sort of tourism space that's now taken up by the digital nomad community.
Right? But I think in Bali, there's an extreme example of digital nomads taking up real estate, just killing the local area.
Well, I also have a question about taxation. And if they're on a work visa, like I wonder how much they're
contributing
taxes are contributing to the economy. Are they ultimately paying taxes domestically, like in the United States?
Very few countries in the world have global tax, and by that I mean in the US, especially, and I think maybe in Australia too, you are taxed on your global income regardless of where you earn it. You'll be taxed on it. Many other countries aren't like that, so if that's not the case, then you're only taxed if you earn income in that particular country, right? So I don't know the tax laws in Vietnam, for example, but if Vietnam does not have a global tax, that means that digital nomads won't be taxed on income they earn in Vietnam.
Right.
Right. So they'll earn US dollars, pay US dollar tax, goes to the US government,
mm-hmm.
right? But the only way that digital nomads living in Vietnam, for example, would pay tax is if there was a local sales tax.
Right. Yeah, right?
Which is a very small percentage
compared
to like income tax,
right.
Wealth tax.
Right? Yeah, so they're not actually feeding the economy with any sort of income tax or property tax or anything. They're really just feeding the economy
and yet they're
the amount
using,
that they buy.
And yet they're using the same roads. They're using the same kind of infrastructure
there
as a local.
But there is an argument to be made that if if they make a lot more because of the exchange rate and the amount of sort of income differential based on Western economies, that they're contributing, you know, they're spending, these are big, like, let's just consider them big consumers. Right? They're spending 10 or 20 times more than your average resident. I'm sure to many degrees, it's advantageous, right?
Let's think about this a little bit more.
Wait, finish your point though.
It just feels like, you know, if it's for the exact same reason tourism is so ideal for a lot of Southeast Asian countries. I mean, I grew up in Hawaii and I've sort of faced this dilemma my whole life. Like, on one hand, tourism fed the economy.
Yeah.
It was an essential part of the prosperity of every local. But on the other hand, you know, a lot of tourists were just referred to as Haoles, even if they were Asian.
Sorry, what's
Haoles? It just means sort of outsider. Typically, it refers to white people, but it can also mean just outsider Asian people that are there, you know, in Waikiki, staying at a fancy hotel. And they were sort of frowned upon by the locals because they didn't feel like real. They were obviously not real, you know, residents, but they fed the economy to a large extent. And everyone I knew, including my father and many of my friends, benefited. So it's tricky. I think there are a lot of shows and there's a lot of like pop cultural sort of touchstones that this reminds me of. And I just, as I was like researching it, I thought of so many things. I thought of The Beach, yeah. The Alex Garland movie that Leo DiCaprio stars in from 2000, where he goes to Thailand looking for like a hidden beach where there's sort of a community of people that live like euphorically. And then it all kind of goes to hell. I also thought of White Lotus, which would be a more sort of recent kind of a commentary on, granted, these are people staying at a hotel. They're not digital nomads, but they are there for long stints. Some of them are staying in this hotel for months at a time, and they become kind of almost like permanent fixtures in another community. The next season's in Thailand, so it feels like an appropriate reference.
You know, I constantly think about this. My mom and dad bought a house in mid-city LA for $78,000 in 1977, right? $75,000 or whatever in 1977. That house today is worth $3 million. If they just stayed there, because they didn't have to leave, if they just stayed there, the thing's like worth $3 million or something like that, maybe $3 million or $2.5 million today. And it's like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a great thing for my mom and dad, right? And that place is like gentrified. It's becoming, you know, the up and coming place. Mid-city is like, you know, all these rich people are moving into these big Victorian homes, like that home that they bought. And it's if they would have stayed and they didn't, you know, move out to more Vietnamese heavy communities, they would have done fine.
But the thing is, with increased property values, in the U.S. at least, I mean, increase property taxes too.
They would only be paying $75,000
on the base.
Yeah, on the base. So if that thing 40 years later is going to be worth $3 million, and gentrification did that to my mom and dad, even if you look at how much they sold the house for, from $75,000 to $450,000 or $500,000, they still did well, you know. And so I get how proponents of anti-gentrification feel. And I get from an anthropological point of view, like, you know, you go in and you displace. I understand that. But I mean, isn't that just the sort of like the natural evolution of society?
Sort of, it's a tangent to a discussion about globalization, right?
Yeah.
And just the inevitable spread, but also diffusion of all culture, right? And the way everything sort of becomes one sort of global thing.
Homogenous, yeah.
Yeah, and big corporations are making this possible, because digital nomads, they work for startups, but they also work for like giant tech companies, right, that allow this sort of travel, you encourage it, which incentivizes it for a lot of people. I think it's interesting. I like to also think about this it from a purely Western point of view, from an American point of view, and just to I think it's worthy taking ourselves through the thought experiment of what leads someone to become a digital nomad, and because that is the Western narrative, that is the narrative that digital nomads around the world exchange with one another. It's how they got wrapped up into this, and it's why they decided to do it. And a lot of them start with the premise that they're stuck in a highly corporate 9-to-5 job, and they're deeply frustrated because they feel sedentary. And they feel like their life is in a kind of a stasis. They may be single, they may have a family that they're the primary earner for, right? Whatever the case, They make the decision to incorporate travel into their work life. So it's not a twice a year trip or once a year trip. It's now an active part of their everyday existence. And I understand that to an extent. I think everyone has a certain lust for travel. And it's, I think it's foolish to deny that that's a part of like all of our kind of collective idealization of what the world has to offer. It's beautiful to travel is, I mean, a lot of writers and artists have written about this stuff, right? Like traveling opens up your worldview, exposes you to new cultures, just gets you out of your shell to an extent.
Around the world in 80 days.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think a lot of digital nomads are approaching this from a very pure and a very idealistic place. Now, I think it's also worthy contrasting that with what the conversations sort of turn into when you hear digital nomads discussing their travels and their kind of priorities as they move from country to country. Yes, they're supporting these local economies. Yes, they're adding probably millions to tourism revenue every year in places like Bali or Thailand. Certainly millions.
And Vietnam.
And Vietnam, absolutely. Or Malaysia or Laos, Cambodia. Like the digital nomads I was listening to hit all the Southeast Asian nations. Maybe less so like a place like Singapore because it's more expensive, but still, I'm sure there are still nomads there. It's disheartening when you start to hear how they speak about the cultures they're engaging in, because there's a lot hinging on, for example, like digital nomads that have gone to Africa, right? A lot of them talk about Cape Town being ideal because even though it's expensive, or more expensive than other parts of Africa, it's westernized, right? And so a lot of them are kind of looking for a bit of a Western bubble.
Yeah.
In a diverse array of locations, like in Southeast Asia.
Well, especially if they're like Wi-Fi is almost a number one thing, right? They can't live without Wi-Fi. So that by itself implies that they only go to very urban centers in any of its countries they go to. Right?
But all of this is going to change soon. You know, the idea of Wi-Fi, Starlink, you know, these ideas of like being able to sign up anywhere and get this, you know, satellite Wi-Fi, you're going to be fine anywhere you go. So
that'll neutralize that. There's a bigger underlying kind of thing that points to, which is that the digital nomads often look for communities with other digital nomads that represent their interests, right? And their subculture in these sort of diverse areas.
Yeah.
So unlike someone that's like, let's say, legitimately moving to Thailand, right, to become kind of a member of the Thai community, they're floated on this small island of other predominantly Western people like them who are all kind of collectively engaging in the tourism economy. And I don't think that's fundamentally bad. I can't quite put my finger on what's strange about that.
Well, isn't that like tourists flocking to Starbucks in every country that they go to?
It's a bit like that.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, it's a good thing. I've talked about this on the podcast, in the coffee podcast. My brother goes to McDonald's, I go to Starbucks when I'm in Vietnam. Why are you judging my decision to go to...
You're visiting a different country for a different experience. Why are you going to...
But because I find that I need comfort. That particular comfort. There are restaurants that I eat at in Vietnam that you would never step in and you would never eat at. So you got to allow me to be able to do my thing. My thing is I want to go to Starbucks to drink cold brew because all that other coffee destroys my stomach.
Right.
Well, that's a health reason, not like a aesthetic.
It's fair, but I also think you sort of disqualified your argument when you said there are the restaurants that you go to that An would never go to, because I don't think anyone that An's referring to that goes to Africa to drink Starbucks or Singapore, right? Or
no, because he's calling me out. I'm not talking on behalf of those people. I'm just
but those people don't go to those restaurants.
Yeah, then let's argue about those people.
Don't
point the gun at me.
Right. Let's
talk about those people.
Yeah, there's no mix and match of Western and Eastern cuisines in a lot of their diet, for example.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Certainly, there are many digital nomads that are out there eating the local cuisine, engaging with the culture.
And moving away from the urban centers that are typical, right?
Yeah. Looking for a stepping stone into a more sort of authentic experience.
And, I can understand that. Yeah. I can understand that.
And that's reasonable. And you don't want to just dive into a place where you don't speak the language and you don't know anyone and there's no one like you, right? That's really hard. But I think there are also others that just sort of float from nomad community to nomad community.
Backpacker touring, right?
It's sort of like backpacking. Yeah. It's also sort of like almost you feel like the backdrop's changing, but the
piece of
story is the same.
The mechanics are the same.
And so there is a preponderance of discussion about like the quality of the sunsets in Africa. A couple of digital nomads were talking on a podcast and they refer to the sunsets in South Africa, in Cape Town, as Disney sunsets because they lasted 2 hours. And they were... That sounds, on one hand, incredibly beautiful, and I would love to see it. But on the other, is that the takeaway from their trip to Africa? You know, and is that, and then, and in no way to sort of politicize this, you know, they talked about safety. A lot of digital nomads discuss safety and where it's okay to go and where it isn't okay to go. And while they were talking about power outages, which are a problem in areas where the grid's not stable, right? One of the nomads also said, and there's always a genocide going on somewhere, a lot of unknowns, just sort of casually in the conversation with sunsets, power outages, and you know, and
blasé, don't you think?
That's the whole point.
I think blasé was definitively blasé. I think it was the definition.
But you know, some people are that tongue in cheek about it, right?
It wasn't like it wasn't a joke.
It wasn't a joke. Yeah. I've heard people the temperature is increasing by 5 degrees. I need to go to a different city. Or a different part of the country because the temperature's gone up 5 degrees. How is that engaging with the local population and engaging with the local culture and trying to figure out and like live like a local to some extent?
Newsflash. I think most of mankind don't give up lying about these things.
I think you're right, but yeah. I would encourage anyone that's curious about this discussion to like go on Apple Podcasts or go on Spotify and just peruse through 10 or 20 digital nomad podcasts quickly. To just sort of hear the tone of discourse.
Yeah.
And the tone of discourse, again, it reminds me of Endless Summer Surfers. They're sort of surfing culture in a way. They're surfing continents and they're surfing countries. And a lot of these countries have deeply ingrained problems and issues and incredible traditions and histories that I think are all not totally
okay.
Registering.
I'm going to ask you guys. I'm going to ask you guys a question.
Can I throw out two statistics? 90% of digital nomads have a higher education, so college or above.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. They're because they're technocrats. Yeah.
And 43% of digital nomads are self-employed. Right, so they
have their own business,
or they contract themselves, etc. And I think many digital nomads work in the IT field, so cybersecurity, digital marketing, coding, etc., where they can do that by themselves, essentially, without a team behind them that needs to be...
Or the managing
team. Jaw, right?
Yeah.
Or things like that. So these are like very, 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 very high, top-level kind of white-collar jobs, right? I just want to point that and then come back to it later.
So here's my question. If we were a governing body in one of these Southeast Asian countries and we had to set the rules, set the regulations... We had to program a program for these digital nomads to come into our place and say, you know what? We're going to offer. So if we're Vietnam, right? We say, we're going to create this program, but here is what we're going to put in the brochure. Here's what we would like for you all to think about before you come into our country and you work as a digital nomad. What would you say in that brochure?
I just don't know if it would matter. I don't know if it would matter.
But if it, let's say it did, and let's just say we could start with like words. Let's say we could start with the printed words on our website. They have to take a test to get this digital nomad visa, you know, and just to create some sort of parameters, like, or even let's just play with me here. If you were to create some idea of, hey, we as this country, we want you to think about these things before you come here. What would they be?
It's funny you ask this because I feel like there's this immediate conflict between the question itself and the tone and kind of tenor of the digital nomad culture, as far as it's represented online and in audio and video anyway. Maybe, you know, maybe on the ground, it's hyper diverse, and I'm discounting a whole slew of digital nomads that would say, oh, I'd want to, you know, I go into the country head first, and I want to learn about the culture and the history, and I want to figure out what separates from other countries. I really want to absorb the reason I'm there and why it's significant that, you know, that I learn about this culture or what all of this it means, like what all of it, I want to contextualize it in a way that's deeper than, you know, sunsets and Wi-Fi speed. But I don't feel, as I listen to people that are part of this community talk, that there would be a genuine interest. And in that regard, I wonder if the country they're in matters much at all, other than that it's tropical, it's got good beaches, sunsets, the rainy season's not bad. Or
just looking for a change of scenery.
It feels like they're shifting their screensaver a little bit. And that's the part that I'm being cynical about.
And I think, Phil, you're right, because I think listening to some digital nomad podcasts, they're really attracted to the ease of entry and exit, right? So if you do impose conditions on a digital nomad visa, I think that'll be a turnoff to digital nomads, right? So from a government perspective, they're looking for high income type individuals to come in, probably high technology type positions or jobs that the digital nomads are in, hoping that those skills will be transitioned to the local population at some point, right? Or in some way. I actually challenge that notion, right? Because if 43% of digital nomads are self-employed, right? And maybe X percent, a significant number of them only stay within the country for 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks. How much skill transfer or knowledge transfer can happen to the local population? And what you're saying, Ken, is that these digital nomads populate Starbucks rather than the local cafe or whatever, how often do they come into contact with locals who are either blue-collar workers or white-collar workers to be able to transfer these skills and experience to the local population? Not much. Exactly.
It's a good question.
Not much. I don't think
they're separated. But if I had to do a really bad impersonation of a digital nomad
it's a good impression recently. Let's hear it.
He had a bit of Topher Grace in his voice, who is a lovely person. And no shade on Topher. But I went to Buenos Aires and had a blast. It was beautiful. A lot of mosquitoes. I went on a run early in the morning. Mosquitoes were chasing me. It was just atrocious. Costa Rica was great, but they were burning sugarcane, and there were all these flies outside. And I guess, you know, in a lot of Asian countries, there's a burning season. You got to watch out. There's trash burning. It's in the air, but the Wi-Fi is great. That's sort of, yeah.
That's what we're getting.
That's sort of what you, what, the, I, and again, I apologize if that's disparaging or
reductive.
Reductive, or I'm not trying to partialize, you know, or downplay the diversity of people that are traveling around the world and just trying to work remotely, because I think as I said, that there's an idealism to that, and there's sort of a beauty to that. But the conversations that I end up hearing about it aren't really about Costa Rica or Thailand or Bali or Vietnam, or, you know, it's like, it's just sort of, was it comfortable? Was it convenient?
Yeah.
Did it support my needs?
But
and
how
my
many
job?
How many people can go in and actually do a podcast that reflects even just the basic ethnography, just the basic, you know, I think Margaret Mitchell was the lady who, you know, goes into these villages, you know, in the Pacific and sits and does an ethnography with compassion. And sits down and explains their point. I think very few people are qualified and even understand that there's this model of sitting with the local culture and really understanding and hearing the people talk, right? I think it's not something that we human beings are really aware of. I mean, even when we're with our friends, it's hard to listen. It's hard to really just be quiet and let the voice of another human being into our body and our. So I think that the majority of like these people who are, you know, tech workers, technocrats are like they're just existing. So how do we infuse this sort of like next level consciousness to these people who are traveling?
I think that's a choice of the person that is the digital nomad. Like you said, some people choose to go for the scenery. Maybe the overwhelming majority of digital nomads go for the scenery. Some may choose to go for the cultural experience. Some may choose to go to experience the people in the local community. What you're asking, Ken, is how can we boost the number of digital nomads that go for the local community and the local people versus and, just a scenery?
And make podcasts that are like moving, that are like that somebody like Phil can listen and consume and be like, wow, you're really thinking about the framing, the understanding of story within the community that you're visiting.
But I think that therein lies the problem is that they're not interested in that at all.
They're just
interested in working and...
But most people are not. Most people are not trained as ethnographers.
Nor should that be the mandate.
Sure.
Right? But...
But there's not even like a drop of even understanding that is kind of like the requirement to do a podcast on the level that you're talking about. Like, let's not talk about sunsets. Let's not talk about Wi-Fi. Let's talk about like something real within the culture and have that discussion. But most people don't do it.
No, but the mere fact that type of podcast does exist for digital nomads just speaks volumes.
Sure. I'm not arguing that. I'm saying that's just normal people doing content.
I think this could be the first wave of digital nomadism, right? It's like we're just there just to surf.
Right.
Surf the scenery.
Absolutely.
Maybe digital nomadism 2.0 would be something more. Right. Just like coffee cafe culture.
We literally thought about that too. I thought about that too.
Yeah. And maybe in judging or over criticizing this first wave, you know, you kind of cut off the second wave before it happens. Not that a podcast or any of us are capable of that. I think digital nomadicism is happening. It's going to continue to grow. You know, as you stated at the top of the show, like it's not going anywhere, and it's feeding these economies who are encouraging more of an influx of remote workers.
But so the fact that you're so aware and keenly aware of the feeling of these podcasts and how vapid it sounds, maybe we are the butterflies that create that, you know, that effect that people are going to change the way they do these, you know.
Well, for me, I see digital nomads as a in between place or status between like a normal tourist and let's say a local resident or a foreigner who expat basically living in a local community, right? So they're in this middle spot, not exactly in the middle, but somewhere along that continuum. Now, most tourists, right, tourists as we define it now, would go to a place for a couple of days to maybe 2 weeks at most, right? And then they fly back to the country. One stat here that's relevant is that 50% of digital nomads prefer to change locations within 1 to 2 weeks of living there, right? So in that continuum between a proper tourist and an expat living in the local community, the current digital nomads 1.0, right, is much more akin to a tourist than they are to an expat.
Mm. They're closer in that spectrum.
Yeah. And so if that's the case, then the reason the digital nomads is a digital nomad is just to surf the scenery, right? They're not there to be an ethnographer, right? Or a sociologist or whatever, right? They're not there to experience the culture and the peoples like an expat would, who is tied to that place because they live and work there or they own property there, right? So maybe we're asking too much of digital nomads at this point in time.
I that's a beautiful observation on, I think it's, we are in the digital nomad DM 1.0, infancy.
Right. And I agree with that. I think
I do. Great point.
Yeah, I think kind of, you know, throwing out the idea that digital nomads have a positive effect is sort of like saying that tourism can't be positive. And I think people that live in these countries would all disagree. They'd say tourism is like lifeblood, you know? And the footprint of these nomads, even if they are sort of just surfing, In the end, they're feeding local economies. So it's also like, I'm divided because I feel like I don't want to go too far in calling out a certain type of bubbled out travel as being shallow, because I think we've all gone on trips to different places. And a lot of times we go in our little hermetic bubble. We go with friends or we go with family.
The shallow visitor.
We're cultural tourists in that instance. And I think every one of us who has traveled probably has some, you know, core memories from those trips. I think even though the fundamental nature of that tourist visit was fleeting and brief and didn't involve a ton of interaction with the locals, right? Beyond, you know, transactions at a cafe or a restaurant or, you know, what have you. I think we still travel because it exposes us to these environments. It puts us in the mix in a way we never would be if we stayed in the US. And I think the thing that we're not acknowledging in the discussion is there are people who are afraid of travel, who would never travel, mm-hmm. who would never leave the state they were born in. You know, and it's not for lack of opportunity. It's that there's a
real fear.
There's a real fear that it will change them in a way that they can't fathom. And they don't want to seek out different cultures or experiences of any kind. So I think digital nomads are a big step up from that. So certainly, so you know,
what I'm hearing from you, Shell, is that digital nomadism 1.0 is more of an intrinsic thing, right? They do it for their own benefit, right? Really, they're not doing it for the benefit of the local community. It's, which
feels fundamentally selfish. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing I'm thinking about.
Oh, it's 1,000% selfish.
Yeah.
But to its
core.
That's 1.0, right?
Yeah. But I think the discussion here is how much of an effect does that selfishness affect the local economy?
Sure. Yeah. And the driving questions for me, or principle for me about all this is, you know, Uncle Ben from Spider-Man. It's like, with great privilege comes great responsibility, right? And what we're kind of pushing or trying to get to is like, do digital nomads have a responsibility to the local economy and the local people?
They definitely do. They definitely have a responsibility to.
Well, I guess how would you quantify that? If you stay in a place longer than a week, do you have a responsibility? If you go there,
no, I think
what is you, it, a month? What's the dividing line?
Just to answer the question that An posed, I think anybody traveling into another country has a responsibility to be very aware that you're stepping foot in somebody's home.
Yeah. So the minute you enter, like, understand that it's not your culture, that it's not there to service you.
Yeah.
That even if there is a service economy built around tourism and nomadicism, it ultimately is its own place with its own customs, traditions, histories, its own people with their own priorities that aren't your priorities.
Yeah.
And just have a fundamental, like, even silent respect for that. You don't need to express it. You don't need to admonish the people there in a way that's condescending or uncomfortable. But just recognizing that you're somewhere else and that that matters and that that's not where you're from. And you may not be the priority. This is really beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think necessary for any world traveler.
Isn't that just good manners though, Phil? Ken? Is that just good manners?
Yeah, but you know the crazy thing is? This is how you know when a newbie arrives in Vietnam, like Vietnamese American diaspora newbies, or the sophistication of a traveler. Like the minute they get there, like if I have cousins or friends that go there and they go with me, the first thing that I have to correct is this constant comparison. Oh, in the US, they would never do that. Oh my God, that's gross. Like, I have to like really dial it in for anybody traveling with me because, I mean, in the early years, I get really upset and I got angry about that. Like, you're not in the United States and you cannot keep commenting it. You gotta like let go of that. And you have to understand that you need to evolve beyond this idea that you're outside of your home and you're in literally like another world and you got to dissipate and let it go. But a lot of people can't let it go. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people can't let it go. They just constantly remind.
And is that more difficult or less difficult if there's a greater or lesser difference between your home country and the country that you're visiting?
That's a great question. The experience that I had with that particular, those examples were just Americans, Vietnamese Americans, going back to, because I had white American friends that came and they didn't talk like that. You know, that's weird, right? Because they know that they're in a different country. So they're not ever comparing, but it's like weird when you are in your own homeland and you've never been here before after 35 years and you're just making all this commentary. Like, I'm like, enough of that. Like, stop that right now. This stops right here today. Day one, we stop that. And we only talk about the beautiful or the ugly things that we're experiencing as human beings. And we don't cross compare.
Comparison is a thief of joy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's sort of like, and I think maybe a lot of the digital nomads today, probably along the 1.0 to conversion to 2.0, are beginning to kind of like maybe understand that. We'll probably hear podcasts from digital nomads 2.0 in a different tone.
They're beginning to grok that, to use the surfing parlance.
I remember it was just a joke when it came out. I mean, it was pre-internet, but it was one of the early seasons of The Real World. You know how they would, remember that MTV show?
Yeah, yeah, sure do.
Like this Seven Daddy Strangers Take to Live in a House. Seven Strangers. It's sort of like a, yeah, just.
I mean, I'm young. I watched it on YouTube like 5 years ago.
They did one in the UK. So just to answer your question about the difference, like, you know, does this happen in similar cultures? It was just Americans in London.
Yeah.
And one of the guys, I think he was from Texas or something, he went to the grocery store, he had a meltdown because he couldn't find ranch dressing. And that was his number one.
American
he was, and dressing. He actually was screaming about it. And he was physically upset because he couldn't
get a meltdown
for dressing. Yeah.
A meltdown.
And
I think that's another episode, ranch dressing. We need to talk about that one.
But it stuck with me because I was like, wow. And growing up cross-culturally, I mean, I guess they're all kinds of, differences of opinion on this, but I feel like I had to just sort of go along to get along.
Yeah.
In both cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And not ask too much and try to just integrate and certainly not expect that everything was either going to be exactly Western or Eastern.
Yeah.
I think there was a certain adaptation required in anyone that comes from like two different, that comes from, that's American and Vietnamese or American Thai, or, you know, like you have to sort of, you have to walk, toe the line a bit. So it's just funny when people have relocated their entire lives and are in a completely different place, yet they don't seem to register that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's hard to register when you have an American bank account. It's hard. It's very difficult because you're like, well,
and in American dollars.
American dollars. Yeah.
It's different when you hold Australian dollars, trust me.
it's different when you have Western dollars and Western bank accounts, and the leveraging is just different. It's just a different thing. Now, like my brother, he decided to move to Vietnam, you know, 20 years ago. And I think like in the early days, he had to shed this idea that he's not one of them. He had to think he's one of them. And the mannerisms, the everything, when you hang out with him, he doesn't talk about the U.S. He doesn't talk about home. He just, this is it. This is my home now. And it's been like that for 20 years from day one.
But does he consider himself American though?
I don't think he considers himself anything anymore.
That's interesting.
Yeah. There's no...
Is that the ideal for a digital nomad, is you don't consider yourself?
I think so. American? That's 2.0 or even 3.0. Yeah, I think so. Because... you know, he's dealing with Sri Lankans. He teaches in a department at the school. He's dealing with a really good friend of his, a Sri Lankan, an Indian guy.
Great cricket team.
and these guys are like now, you know, have been friends with him for 7 years or 12 years. And he's known a bunch of Hungarian guys and German guys. And so this world that he lives in is very international, but very loving to their new home, Vietnam. And they're not digital nomads. These are people who are expats.
Yeah, expats.
It's another conversation.
It's, yeah, they feel far more ingrained.
Yeah.
Found some other terms that were interesting. Maybe they felt relevant, I don't know. But the certain digital nomads, especially in South America, call each other slow mads. Because I guess they like living slow.
Mm.
They also refer to their community as a Wi-Fi tribe, which...
You have a problem with this. Why do you, tell me, why do you have a problem with Wi-Fi.
No, Wi-Fi is fine. Just the word tribe feels a bit, but who knows?
Just an aside. You're
not judging.
You're in France. It's pronounced Wi-Fi.
Vietnam too.
Yeah.
Wi-Fi. Wait, no, Wi-Fi. I've heard it both ways. But technically, if you pronounce it in Vietnamese, it's pronounced Wi-Fi. Yeah.
In French.
Because, I is pronounced with the E.
Yeah.
So it's Wi-Fi.
It's Wi-Fi.
So what's our takeaway in the end? Is it the digital nomadicism beta version 1.0?
Needs to evolve.
Yeah. And will, but ultimately, irrespective of maybe some of the drawbacks that are akin to a kind of long form cultural tourism, it's ultimately good for these economies.
It's good until it becomes saturated, I think.
Can we talk about the negatives here?
Sure.
All right. So ideally,
Debbie Downer.
No,
I'm kidding. We have to talk about it. This is part of it.
Ideally, I think the impact on local economy would be things like spending money in the country, which you talked about, Ken, in the beginning, fostering entrepreneurship, sharing knowledge and skills, of course, spurring innovation, and creating new business opportunities. Now, ideally, that would happen, right? But that's hard to occur, especially the last three or four of those. If a digital nomad is only there for 1 to 2 weeks, or 50% of digital nomads are in a country for 1 or 2 weeks, that's very difficult to do. That knowledge and skill transfer, and even starting businesses and helping the local economy, where the long-term effects of that to be felt are much greater if that happens, right? One thing we didn't talk about, we sort of touched upon very early in the podcast episode, is the impact on real estate, right? So if a digital nomad is earning US dollars, they're going to want US or Western style accommodation in an urban center or whatever it is. That means they're going to price out locals, right? And that means that locals can't afford to live in the urban centers anymore. They're going to push out further and further, just like gentrification. I think some of that, those negative effects of digital nomads 1.0 is kind of ameliorated if you transition into like an expat, where they do embed themselves in the local community, where they do start becoming part of the tax base, where they do become part of the landholding class there, and basically, you know, acting like a local. But digital nomads 1.0 can have quite significant negative effects on the economy and the people there as well. And I just want to recognize that and just, you know, put it out in the open here. But like I said, I think we're talking about how digital nomads 1.0 can evolve into 2.0, where we see more emphasis on the responsibilities that they have to the local communities, and that being a much more upfront and kind of human-centered, if you will, as part of their experience.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a problem eventually, because if you're only at 35 million right now worldwide, and you go to 1 billion in 2035, that's a real fast build up to saturation. Mm-hmm. In because when I think about like Saigon, right, there's 12 million people roughly in that city. How many of these digital nomads is really affecting the real estate price? Because this is like, you know, Saigon District 1 is like probably top 10 in the world in terms of real estate pricing. It's like super expensive.
It's interesting. It's like there's sort of a tipping point, right, where if the digital nomad population's below a certain number, its effects probably aren't so great on displacing locals. But if it increases to an extent that it passes whatever that
threshold,
whatever that
is,
red line is, right, then suddenly locals are displaced to create more room, more accommodations, more of a bubble for digital nomads, which may not be occupied all the time. And then you get this weird effect where it's like living in a resort town that has an off season, everyone's gone, but they own this property and it's empty. And or, some of the real estate on the east side bought up by very rich, international investors.
Yeah.
And then never lived in. And then it's just sort of sits there because it's an investment property.
Well, what exactly is the definition of gentrification in the United States? Because does it mean like white people moving into a colored people's neighborhood? I mean, what is the exact definition here?
I think it's white and Asian now.
Okay. All right. So think about it.
So I think it's high earning, high mobility.
But different color? Like you have to be a different... from a different community?
A different racial. Usually it is.
So in the United States, gentrification means that, right? But what about in Vietnam when a neighborhood was like District 4 was like super poor, gang infested, and it had cleaned up, and then they just like all of a sudden was just like beautiful, right?
How many locals were displaced?
Yeah, that's the downside. So
I think the government did that because it was along the
government. The government cleaned up and has made it more beautiful. And
right. Whatnot, so right? Is that a gentrification when the government comes in and cleans up?
Yes, because it's displaced.
Well, the textbook definition is the process whereby the character of a poor urban area is changed by wealthier people moving in, improving housing and attracting new businesses, all good things, but typically displacing the current inhabitants in the process.
So what if the government did that? Is it gentrification or is it like the move of like developers, rich people?
But developers come in because the government allows them to come in, right?
Yeah, and I think a good...
What came first in District 4?
A good example would be like Williamsburg in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Right? Like big corporations came in and started developing like condos for
which requires government approval.
Right. And those condos displaced a lot of local residents. And that was sort of the second wave of gentrification. The first wave felt a little more hipster, a little cooler. It was like baristas and cool shops.
It was like the early wave.
The early wave was
light.
Was fun.
Yeah,
you know, and fun. it was attractive because it was bringing in new business, new money. There were still locals around. Sort of.
That's 1.0.
That's 1.0. But the second wave was like
now the big guns. Big guns come in.
Big glass luxury condos that were now marketing not to to people sort of riding that line, to urban professionals that needed cheaper housing. Now they were marketing to like the financial district. And,
yeah.
You know, and they were trying to get Manhattanites with tons of money to come over to Williamsburg.
See, and I think it's two different things. I think what Phil is talking about is very different from like digital nomads gentrifying prices of the local economy. I don't think it's at that scale yet.
Yeah. But with 1 billion, that's so. Let's talk about that 1 billion number.
It's right? A seventh of the population.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So most of the digital nomads we have now, you know, half of them at 17 million from the US and another 18 from the rest of the world, most likely Western Europe.
Developed
countries. In the future, 1 billion, what percentage of them will be white or from the industrialized worlds? And what percentage will be coming from the, you know, quote unquote now developing worlds?
Yeah.
Or
who knows?
Well, I think do you think it'll be the same ratio, or do you think it'll be like 90% people from China and Vietnam?
It depends on how
they, I think almost digital nomadism most mandates that you're paid a premium for your work, yeah, and your services. That's what allows you mobility.
Do you think in 10 years United States will have that power, the buying power?
Germany, yeah.
You think so?
They have to. Like, yes, there will be more in terms of the number of like digital nomads from India, for example, because they're very high tech, right? Or from Taiwan or China or maybe in Vietnam. But they're not going to be.
What are they paid?
Exactly.
That's, and if they're not paid a premium, a global premium, right? Then they don't actually have the mobility
and
to become nomads.
And you can't exploit the leverage.
Yeah, so we should acknowledge that.
Yeah,
digital nomadicism is a privilege of the West. It's it's a privilege of a certain
class,
right? And not everyone in the world can do this.
Yeah.
Can pop around and live in different places.
So there's that, right? The other part of it is with the number of 1 billion, right? Out of a population of what, 6, 7, 8 billion, right? From 35 million now. Can you imagine the immigration effects of that?
I think
like 1 billion moving every 2 weeks.
I think it'd be kind of beautiful.
One month.
I think it's beautiful. I think it's awesome.
But if they're swarming, right, due to weather, for example, right?
That's
like 1 billion people swarming into Southeast Asia, and then 2 months later, they'd swarm into South Africa.
Wow. You start to have the effects of
a big
migration.
Yeah.
You start to have the effects of a refugee migration. Yeah. But now it's
and because it's
organized.
But no, not just organized. Now it's a first class
Class
voluntary refugee migration.
Yeah. And right? Then what happens? the buildings and the cafes, whatever that service those will be vacant for 8 months of the year.
Which you see and in off seasons, in tourist economies.
Locals be able to live in those places. It's a huge effect, right?
Yeah, but huge effect. A lot of the economies will be dominated by tourism, even if it's a second or sort of third tier industry.
Wow, this is like, we need to talk about climate change as it's going to affect Southeast Asia, because this is a huge...
Digital Nomad 2.0 will be bicycling everywhere.
Right, but when you scale transportation to that extent, right, you're scaling up on the strain on energy, and you're scaling up on the...
Can you imagine how many...
It can only scale up as fast as infrastructure allows it to. You can't just like scale up and then like, you know, like we can't handle the traffic. It has to like grow. I think governments are going to have to see it and grow it. So it's not going to swarm the way we're like, they're not like bees where they could just take off like and go. I think it's going
to... Well, if you look at digital nomadicism as antithetical to the COVID lockdowns, right? And you remember the effects of the COVID lockdown on the climate, on the environment. They're massive. The upside to a very dark time was that the air got really clean.
Yeah.
Pollution decreased.
I remember like half a degree lower.
Global cooling because nobody was going anywhere because we weren't straining the infrastructure of our cities and our transportation systems.
Yeah.
Right. Digital nomadicism scaling up to that extent goes in the reverse direction. And you'll start to see a dramatic heightening and acceleration of all of the negative effects on the climate.
With straight, the infrastructure is going to be huge. With 1 billion.
I think climate change and the way the world is, you know, the rising seas, I think that's a really good episode in the next discussion or down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also bears mentioning that unlike a big refugee population that's forced to migrate to another location, you know, wedged onto a plane, wedged onto a bus or a boat, right? And then exiled and pushed across an ocean or, you know, from continent to continent. Despite the demands of that on transportation systems, it's nowhere near the demands of a first-class, voluntary, digital nomad migration. In which, I mean, if you just look at basic metrics, right, they say that if everyone lived like Americans across the globe, you'd need 4 globes to sustain the world's population.
Yeah.
Right? So you can imagine that we're talking about a multiplier of kind of a
maybe just 2 globes just to satisfy the digital nomads.
In other words, if you took, let's say you take a half a billion refugees and you force them across the globe to relocate, resettle, right? Then you take a half a billion digital nomads. That half a billion digital nomads is going to have a footprint of 4 times at least the refugee population that was forced to migrate. Wow. So yeah, so that's a lot of
infrastructure talk.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, awesome. I think we came to some sort of agreement that digital nomads are both good and bad for these local economies. I think on you lean a little bit more that it's bad long term. I think for me,
for version 1.0,
yeah, for version 1, I think we're on the same page. And I think there's going to be more to talk about this in the next few years.
It's a great stopping point right there.
Great.
Yeah.
Awesome, guys.
Thank you.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.